Hey, before we get started, we got a little update on the t-shirt promo that we did a couple weeks back, and we said it was going to be pre-order, it's going to take 4 to 6 weeks to process. We had a bit of a snafu in that our first vendor, we got 3 weeks into the project, or 2 weeks into the project, and they just stopped all communication with us.
Yeah.
Which made us have to switch vendors in the middle of the stream. The good news is we just got the proof shirt, and we should actually get all of the shirts that we ordered in this week. I'm not sure whether we can get them out the door this week or next, but they should come out soon. I know a lot of people are concerned about, if their addresses change or just if they're being ripped off by us. We thought about it. We thought about taking,
we did the math.
Yeah. And it's like, continuing club sales and Amazon support versus a one-time infusion of t-shirt money. And it turns out the odds were in your guys' favor.
Just barely. Just barely. Yeah. So keep that on your radar.
It's like one of those, the war machine situation in war games. It's like we had to simulate, 500-600 different scenarios. But like I said, I do think that they are going to be out the door and probably at your house, bar international orders, by September.
I'm going to run it by the Whopper one more time. Once more.
Sure. You got to be sure. Because we still haven't, the shipping. God, my God. Did we think about the shipping?
Oh, yeah. That might
Did we think about the envelopes? Did we think about that?
I think so.
The ink cartridge we might have to buy extra to print all these labels. Mm. But those are coming. I'm not going to tell you what the t-shirt is because I got yelled at because they're very, very minor spoilers that if you looked at an Entertainment Weekly anytime in the last 5 years, you also got the shit spoiled out of you. But if you know what I'm talking about, and I think you do, t-shirts will be arriving your way shortly.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
Ooh, and I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 5, titled The Wolf and the Lion. I think everybody gets the metaphor here, understands it all, yeah?
Yeah. Who do you got in the wolf and lion fight?
Oh, the lion. The lion, clearly. Ned was beaten.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I like this episode. I like this episode a lot. There's a lot of humor. It's a lot of intrigue, just a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and I forgot the showpiece scene, in my opinion, is the emotional showdown between Cersei and Robert, which
right.
Obviously I'd forgotten because that would have weighed in heavily in our discussion of, whether Cersei's child is a fake or a lie or whatnot. But it's just, it's great. And
it is. It feels like an honest moment between, a couple of characters that are at times tough to like, especially Cersei.
Sure.
And it feels like she kind of levels and becomes a real human being and kind of gives you her true feelings for a minute.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a standout. And yeah. I know a lot of people, I think it's Mark Addy is a guy that played Robert, that there's been opinions pro and con about him being Robert. I thought he's a great fat. I think he's a great fat Robert. I mean, I feel like a lot of book purists really get into the physical, do they really exact? And I've always thought that it's better to nail someone who's got the personality.
Yeah.
And this guy, he's way too short to be Robert of the books.
Is he? Okay.
Well, I don't think he's as tall as Cersei, for God's sake.
Sure. I don't know how tall he's supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, he's just, in the book, he just gets an impression that he's just this beast, mm-hmm. and he's slaying people with his Warhammer and whatnot. And yeah, he gets fat and goes to seed, but you should still see him being kind of an impressive guy. But mm-hmm. just the drinking, whoring, glutton, short-sighted, impetuous Robert, I feel like this guy nailed. And this scene is a great kind of, I can't say enough good about it.
It's interesting because I don't know that I consider him short-sighted, all that short-sighted. In some matters, he is. Like, when it comes to the Targaryens, certainly, he's short-sighted.
But as he gives a really, in this, that's what's so amazing about the scene is by the time Robert gets on the scene, you're thinking, maybe Ned's the one that's short-sighted.
Yeah, and everybody who thinks, they're just going to hide behind the castle walls, that does seem silly. He lays out a very plausible scenario of how that goes down.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end well for them.
Yeah.
So I don't know that he's all that short-sighted. He is gregarious, which I like at times.
Sure.
He's also short-tempered.
Yeah.
Which you see a lot from him.
Maybe I should say impetuous like rather than short-sighted. Because okay. It does seem like you get his okay. blood up, right. And you know, I don't think you get master tactician, strategist Robert. You get, you know.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy to do that. It
yeah.
seems, so.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that would be, if maybe Robert would have been a better king at the small council, would have been, you know, like isolate him a little bit more from those things that would piss him off and, mm-hmm. and get him all riled up and just.
All he wants to do is drink wine.
That's can, true. I don't think there's anything that's going to make Robert a good king.
Yeah, probably not.
But, you know, I know that's one of a lot of the popular debates when I first gotten into reading the books is like, what if Ned, you know, what if Ned sat the Iron Throne instead of Robert? And I don't know that would have, you know, it would have gone bad for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it's really hard to be a king of seven kingdoms.
Maybe the people would have liked him better, but I don't know that he sticks around long enough.
Right.
Like,
yeah. And I don't.
I don't think he's smart enough for it.
Right. I feel like Robert's a fairly popular king, though.
You think,
you know,
so?
This is like after the Mad King,
well,
and
yeah.
you've had like the longest summer in like probably anyone's living memory, certainly, maybe even recorded history, and you know, with people being God fearing. That's got to be a good omen, and he's putting on a lot of jousts, and he's putting on a lot of tournaments, and mm-hmm. you yeah. know, he's like the JFK, like, you know, he chased tail, but the reporters knew what was up, and they carried his water for him, and people loved him.
All right. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Let's get into the recap. We start off with Ned going to see Sir Hugh's body, and he asks some questions of Sir Barristan. He kind of senses something is up with Hugh's death here, and Barristan tells him that Robert's thinking of jousting. So Ned goes to see Robert, who's struggling to fit into his armor, to put it nicely. he sends Lancel for the breastplate stretcher, and Ned convinces him not to attempt to joust.
Mm.
I really love this scene with Robert.
There's a lot of great, like, they do a lot of such good characterizations, and I know we've said this a lot, but, like, the way they... So, coming out of this scene, how do you view Barristan Selmy? Like, he definitely, I mean, he's the only...
He seems to be buddy-buddy with Ned, and I think that's because they respect each other.
Right. And that's, you know, that was, you can see that he respects Selmy in the way he doesn't Pycelle, because he greets Pycelle, mm-hmm. like, yeah, I remember we were on opposite sides of the war, and it's kind of a dick to him, but Selmy, he respects mm-hmm. him as a warrior. We also know that Selmy's the only one that stood vigil over the young knight, like, the ideals of knighthood are important to him.
Yeah.
And also that, you know, he's kind of circumspect about, you know, serving under the Mad King and maybe serving under a bad king.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, there's the other, I forgot why everyone debate, like, God, the favorite thing for people to do in the first two seasons was debate swordsmanship and skills, because they do kind of bait you. Okay. Like, I just said a definitive thing about, like, you know, my read of Ned on the last episode is that he's a great field commander, not necessarily in even the top 10. Greatest swordsman, but then Barristan Selmy says, I saw you cut down a dozen great knights. I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah. And he holds his own against Jaime, who, you sure. know, is fabled to be pretty good.
And, you know, you also wonder, was Jaime, like, relishing
right.
the fight? Yeah. Like, oh, I get to actually fight someone that's important now? Or yeah, but still.
This isn't stabbing a king in the back.
Yeah, again, not super interested. That shit, you know, all day, every day on some of the other forums. But yeah, I see why people did get up in it, because mm-hmm. swordsmanship seemed like it was a big thing in the first few seasons. It kind of drops off later on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, if you can just wait and see it on the screen,
uh-huh.
if you're wondering who's a badass and who isn't.
Right.
Or maybe not, you know?
That's There's what I'm saying.
A lot of people don't get their opportunity.
It's a worked match, man. It's a yeah. worked match.
All right, so the joust begins. So
oh,
Loras,
wait, we yeah. also, what I just want, with the fact that his squire is a Lannister, do we want to...
I don't know.
And just a lot of, like, just King Robert seems so unhappy. He's saddled with this wife he didn't want, but Jon Arryn.
Surrounded by Lannisters.
Yeah.
He fucking hates these people.
Yeah, and I love
and they're
how
everywhere.
This is Kevin Lannister. This is the, we you don't know this, but just to outline the family dynasty here, mm-hmm. Tywin Lannister is the big bad Lannister that's got all the gold and
Daddy
everyone's
Lannister.
In debt to.
Yep.
His brother, Kevin, is also respected. You know, general and leader, and this is his son that's squiring for Robert, who he's calling. Said, you know, this is Kevin's wife. He's saying, your mother's a dumb whore with a fat ass.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Like, and there's nothing Lancel can do. It's so, oh, God.
Yeah, and the way he fucks with him with this breastplate stretcher thing.
Sure, sure.
Which, I don't know, I could conceive of a breastplate stretcher being
yeah,
a real
like,
what, thing.
I mean, that's the thing. Like,
you heat that thing up and you pull it. Why not?
Most craft industries have something similar to this, where you tell someone yeah. to fetch a certain that, you know, if you've been in the job a month, you know, it's patently ridiculous.
Right.
But
right.
it's like, well, shit, I guess, you know, people do get fatter, you know, bigger.
Yeah.
You need
like,
to...
oh, that's an ID10T error.
Right, 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 right. Or PEBCAC or whatever.
Sure.
But, yeah, and the fact that he almost goes out just completely not dressed because he's so drunk and besotten that
yeah.
he doesn't even know.
Yeah, it's a really good, I mean, he's easy to like in these moments, you know?
Yeah.
So now the joust begins. Sir Loras gives Sansa a flower, but he's kind of eyeing Renly. We'll see why later. Gregor's horse is acting up, and Loras wins the joust, which costs Littlefinger 100 gold. Are they just, this is D&D economy? It's just 100 gold
yeah,
pieces?
Sure.
Like, okay.
Press Latinum, whatever.
Fair enough.
I mean, I that's the thing. Like, 100 gold pieces seems kind
like
of...
Like a lot.
Does it? Or does it seem kind of...
It depends on how big the gold pieces are. Like, I'm thinking coins made entirely out of gold. That seems like a lot of cash.
Yeah. I don't know, like, is a stat... Like, they talk about coppers, stats, and like, copper, silver
right.
stags, and gold dragons... Like, is a stag about a buck?
I mean, if it's World of Warcraft economy, then...
Because here's the thing.
The gold's probably like a $100 bill.
Okay.
Is what I'm thinking.
That's a shit ton of money.
I know.
Because I was thinking more of along the line that this is like $1,000. And like Littlefinger, the master of coin, and Rinley, brother of the king, you would think that's like, you know, if Charles Barkley comes up and says, I'll put $100 on it at a casino, you're like, oh. You're like,
whatever, cheapskate.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Ooh, you're rolling big. You know, if Charles Barkley puts down $100,000 on it, then you know, he's got some skin in the game.
Right.
So I don't know. It seems like it's supposed to be a significant bet. Like, you can buy...
He's going to buy a new whore, apparently. So, yeah. Buying a person, that seems
like a good amount of money. But you can rent a porn star in Vegas for $2,000. Like,
right, but he's going to buy one.
Oh, but that's true.
Like, he's going to have that person there.
Although, what does that mean when he buys them? Because slavery's outlawed in Westeros.
Right, like pays them for like a contract, probably.
Right.
To serve in his brothels for X amount of time.
And also, it does seem like, even with some of Varys' dialogue, I can't remember if this episode or next, but it's not really, it's the minorest of spoilers, but it does seem like that maybe there's some human trafficking going on.
Right.
Outside the books. Off the books.
Yeah.
I think is the actual phrase.
There are no books. Who can even write this stuff down?
So the spreadsheet's all in Littlefinger's mind.
Yep. So the Mountain's pissed about losing, and he chops the head off his horse, and then he comes after Loras. But the Hound jumps in to defend him, and they fight until the king orders him to stop.
This is badass, man. The fact that the Hound kneels to the king, and also, you know,
like,
dodges
how much
a beheading swing.
How much trust do you have in the power of the king to do that, right? Like,
well,
here
also
comes the killing blow. You're going to duck and just hope that the Mountain stops.
Well, the other thing is, we've been led to believe to this point that the Hound is kind of this, you know, he rode down the Butcher's Boy, and he's a Lannister lackey,
right.
And like, completely, he's not a knight, conspicuously. It's like, fuck, you know, the knights and all that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in this one moment, there's a clear, stark difference between him and his brother. His brother's
absolutely
a mad dog, and he has respect for the institution of the king, if not the king himself. So I thought, you know, it's badass, and it says a lot about his character.
It does. And the fact that he's willing to jump in here and defend Loras, who, you know, didn't do anything wrong necessarily.
Right.
He took advantage of, I guess, the Mountain's horse being in heat.
So the Mountain's horse is a boy who obviously doesn't
and
have his balls clipped, and he rode up a female horse that's gagging for it.
That's all fair. All seems reasonable to me.
It's a ruse de guerre.
Like, that's on the Mountain.
Yeah.
You know your horse is in heat. Don't fucking ride it to a joust.
Yeah, or get a female horse. Or, you know, let the horse ride you. Right. Because that's the thing. It's like, he's so huge, man, on that horse.
He is. Really is.
My favorite Mountain, by the way, still. Like, you don't see him a lot in season one, but,
he's a pretty mean-looking Mountain. The other thing the Mountain's got going for him is he's the only person, maybe aside from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who could pull this off. Chop the head right off a horse.
Yeah, one shot, bam.
Yeah.
Bam.
I mean, I don't know that he chops it clean off,
nah,
but
he gives it a good chop. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you need a horse executioner, the Gregor Clegane is your man.
Yeah. It's impressive.
Also, Littlefinger rubbing. We find something about Rinley that we didn't know before.
Mm-hmm.
Rinley is a closeted gay man in the realm.
Right, closeted for good reason in this universe.
And Littlefinger has no compunction about.
Right,
like, you keep running your mouth about me and my friends, and I'm going to out you.
Like, I thought he did right here and now in the stands.
It's one of those things where, like,
This is like a fake private conversation.
Well, it's kind of like with Liberace running around in the 70s. Like, it's kind of an open secret. But if you are, like, I've heard tell of, like, women that just were madly in love with him, and they had no idea that he was gay.
Right.
And, now that we know everything we know about the homosexuality is open, it's like, oh, well, of course Liberace's gay.
Right.
But in the day, it's like, oh, he's just flamboyant, and he's finely dressed, and he cares about his personal appearance. And I feel like that some of these rubes in King's Landing, since, you know, being gay is such a terrible thing in this show universe.
Yeah.
Books are a lot more circumspect about all these relationships. But... yeah, like, maybe you just wouldn't know. Like, have your friend, for dinner, of course.
Right.
They'll probably arm wrestle and do other manly things, shave each other's chests, that kind of thing.
But right, but it probably makes a lot of sense that Littlefinger, of all people, would be able to spot this, right? He
sure.
deals with all kind of different sexualities in his work. Plus he also has spies around. He might have, like, caught a glimpse of
I also wonder if we're supposed to understand that Littlefinger maybe has supplied, you know, if Renly is hard up in King's Landing and he wants someone to help him out.
Yeah.
Go to Littlefinger.
Because Loras is just in town for the tournament, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't, like, hang around King's Landing very often.
No, he's from the Reach.
Okay. So Catelyn's party has stopped to camp. She's got Tyrion prisoner, in case you forgot. Tyrion realizes they're headed to the Vale in order for him to answer for his crimes. He's explaining he didn't kill Jon or try to kill Bran when they're attacked, and they fight off the attackers with Tyrion saving Catelyn's life in the process. Surprise attack here. They went out of their way. They really did, like, a whole ruse and everything to not get attacked on the road, and here it is.
Well, I mean, they were doing the ruse for Lannister agents. This is the hill folk or the mountain tribes so they're just attacking.
It's just random, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, hey, this looks like a fairly lightly defended convoy of fine ladies and lords. Let's see if we can get some Castle Ford steel and some gold.
I guess they didn't realize how many badasses were in the group, including fucking Sideburns, who
right
does some damage here.
Yeah,
I mean, impressed.
He's not the master of arms of Winterfell for nothing. not for his lordly display of Sideburns. Tyrion kills a dude with a shield.
He does, in brutal fashion.
And there's this other dude, squirrely looking dude with the goatee that seems like he's pretty badass as well. The one that gave up his room for Tyrion. I wonder if we'll see him again.
Oh, right. I thought it looked a little fake when Tyrion was attacking this dude. Like, that first swing he takes with the shield doesn't seem like it would knock this guy to his knees or even stun him or hurt him at all.
Mm.
But then when he has him on the ground and he's digging the point
just
of that shield into his face.
That. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal. And he saves Catelyn's life, so... Like, I think this, I don't know, does this change? Because he's making a lot of good points here about, oh, I've been very busy, I've killed so many people, how could I have done all that and
I
whatnot.
I think, and also he says something about her sister, like, when's the last time you saw her sister? She's different now. Like, I feel like that throughout this whole episode, Kat's wearing the, I've made a huge mistake. She's like Job in Arrested Development.
Right.
She just that's the face she's wearing the entire episode.
Yeah.
And but, then when you he know, just when life, he's it's... about to get on her good side, he goes and makes a ribald joke about her. And she clutches her Winterfell pearls and resolves that he's still an asshole.
Sure. So we go over to Winterfell. Theon's practicing his archery while Bran's going over the sigils and the words of all the great houses with Master Luwin.
Which is an education for him and also us as the audience. It's
right.
Getting into your brain some of these things so that when you're later hit with it, you know, the third or fourth time you hear these and you're like, oh, right, that family. It's it's a little brain worm for you.
Yeah. I almost get the impression that, like, you know, he was being trained to be a warrior and whatnot with a bow, and then once his legs gave out, now they might be training him to be a proper lord.
Okay.
But, of course, he was learning this stuff before.
Sure.
He kind of already knew a lot of the words, but he can't remember the Lannister house words, or he pretends not to know them.
Yeah, he's being kind of sansing up a little bit.
Right.
In my opinion.
He's mad that his mother left him there in Winterfell, left him all alone.
Which this all makes really good sense, and I thought that the maester Luwin was really good with Bran. I mean, lots of nice,
he's
quiet.
Like, you know this stuff. Come on.
And the real reason he's sulking is because his mom abandoned him at a point where, you know, arguably a boy going through something as traumatic as being paralyzed, and you had this childish dream of being a knight, and, you know, it's one thing, it's like, you know, hey, kid, you can be anything you want, the President of the United States, an astronaut, a cowboy, whatever you want to be, and you can believe that really late in the life.
Sure.
Until the world, you know, and by the time the world beats it out of you, you're kind of emotionally prepared for it.
Right.
8 years old, you're paralyzed, well, you ain't going to be a warrior no more.
Or an astronaut.
And
guess what? It's medieval times.
And And Lewin kind of gives it back to him a little bit. Like, hey, you know, if Lord Tyrion's done his homework, maybe you can sit a horse and shoot arrows.
And he does, you know. Yeah. I mean, this is kind of cool. So I don't know. I feel bad for him, certainly, but he is being a little shit here. I like the smirk on his face where he's talking about the Lannister words and he pretends that they're family duty honor, which we know what he's seen. How much of that he remembers, I think, is still up in the air because he's telling people that he doesn't remember
it. Oh, I think you misheard because he's talking. This is actually a dig at his mother. The Tully's words are family duty honor.
I thought it was both.
Yeah, like, that's right. He listed off a whole bunch of different words.
Yeah.
But he came on that so that he's like, you know, family's the most important, right? Well, where's my... Yeah, so...
Oh, I thought he was also going the, you know, fucking your sister and brother kind of angle, too.
No, I don't think he remembers that.
I'm trying to figure out what he actually remembers and what he's telling people he doesn't remember.
Right.
Just... because he doesn't want to get in trouble.
Yeah, you not even thought about him trying to pass off his head injury as a reason he can slack off for his studies.
Right.
Right. Well, I don't remember. I just dropped from a tower, maester.
Yeah, let's drop you from that tower. See how much you remember. So we go over to Theon, who's fucking his favorite whore. I don't know
fucking
this.
Fucking her. Like, she's a snack machine that took his money. He just...
okay.
Shaking it, rocking it, trying to get all the candy out.
God.
I mean, he's really giving it to her.
Yeah, well, he's
getting his copper's worth.
Sure is. What's her name? I don't
know. Roz.
Roz, okay. So she's teasing Theon about her many other noble clients, and eventually she kind of angers him. She gets under his skin by bringing up the fact that he's a ward of the family who killed his own family.
He's being a fucking dick here. You know, like, I don't...
Literally. I've seen it.
He's being a fucking dick. He is. He's reduced himself to being a fucking dick. I don't know... To me, this scene is a little repetitious because in the last, you know, five episodes, this story has come up three times.
This is the problem I have with this and later on with Rob and him and, like...
Right.
They're really driving this point home, and I don't know if it's that they're trying to push him over the edge, finally.
Yeah, and or is it just for the audience, like, seriously, this is not a real Stark. You guys need... They all kind of look the same. They all have the same haircut and they're dressed the same, but this guy is different. I don't know, but I thought it was a little tedious. And also, you know, it kind of makes that Tyrion... Theon to be a bad guy because, you know, Roz is just trying to make her way in the world, man. She's not wanting to...
Theon's
provide her
a little,
ample breast to whoever's got the coppers to pay for him. And Theon, what the fuck?
He's getting too attached, right? And she's trying to squash that. She doesn't want this. She doesn't want that to happen. I don't know.
It seems particularly cruel for, even though he's a hostage, he's still a highborn guy in a much better position. And he's lording over the fact that she is just some git from a poor cook.
Sure.
Like, yeah, damn, dude.
Yeah, no, it's not cool what either of them are doing, I guess. But I guess I understand Roz way more than I understand.
That's the thing. That's all. That's
well,
also...
Theon. So Theon's trying to knock her down a peg because, you know, she's been fraternizing with Tyrion and like all these other nobles she mentions. Yeah. It's like,
tell me the dwarf's got a small cock. Tell me that guy. That's what I got to hear.
Right.
I mean, come on.
He's trying to, like, knock down her sense of pride or
I know, just
her self-confidence so that she'll be with him. It's this real weird neg sort of deal happening.
Knocking
that,
down the pride and self-esteem of a whore.
I know.
And she's in this position where, like, you know, whoring today is dangerous. You're with the dude and, like, you just knock every teeth out of your mouth. And what are you going to do? He's the lord and you're the whore. I think she's trying to kind of playfully disarm him, but it's walking a fine line.
It is, yeah. So we go over to Arya chasing cats. And that's a real brief scene where she's not great at this. She's really not great.
Cats are not the easiest to catch.
Well,
especially street cats.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a house cat that's never known a day of cruelty or a day of hunger. They're one thing. You can just scoop right. them up by the bushel full. But a hardened street cat that's from generations of strays.
I mean, there are peasant kids chasing this cat all day.
Oh, probably trying to catch him and eat him.
Yeah.
Or just fuck with them. Set them on fire for their own amusement to relieve the right. boredom of their lives. Like, yeah.
This cat's brother was burned alive.
Sure.
In the streets of King's Landing. It
I let a little
better.
Girl catch me once. Lost my left eye.
But yeah, she fails at that. Then we go over to Ned. Varys is asking him about how Bran's doing, really just to get his foot in the door, and then tells him that the king's going to be poisoned, just like Jon Arryn was. He tells him that Sir Hugh's the one who poisoned Jon Arryn because he started asking questions.
And oh boy, we're starting to like, man, last episode you really like Littlefinger, but boy, Varys is talking a good talk too.
He is, yeah.
He's using all the best words. I feel like it's really hard to see who's telling the truth, and they really make
it is.
Like,
and they who's really, on which side?
They really make it seem from the audience position, like if you're they're putting you in Ned's position. Mm-hmm. Like you are not an expert at playing this game. You don't know all the players, and they're all telling you things that are flattering and seem like they have the ring of truth. And you know they're yep. giving you things that you want to know. The further your pursuit of this truth, so.
Yeah, and I really love both Varys and Littlefinger, and when we get to them both in the throne room later, mm-hmm. man, what a good scene that is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he finds out quite a bit here, or, you know, he's told quite a bit here.
Right.
Whether it's true or not, who knows.
And that's the thing, this next scene with Arya in the tunnels and the dragon skulls
yeah.
is super fascinating on the heels mm-hmm. of this one.
Yeah, there's a lot of Varys stuff here. So we go on to Arya, who chases the cat into the dungeons, where she overhears Varys telling, what's his name? The Targaryen
Illyrio.
Counselor.
Illyrio. He's the one that's was sheltering Viserys and Daenerys over in Essos.
Right.
Pentos, in fact, this is the city.
Okay. So he's Varys is telling that guy that the wolf and the lion will soon be at each other's throats, and they need to kind of delay until Khal Drogo's son is born.
Yeah, so what... I mean, they say a lot because, like, Illyrio suggests, well, if he's getting too close, we, you know, a one hand can die, why not two? Does that imply that they were complicit in the death of Jon Arryn? And Varys, when he says, oh, I don't know, is that because he's trying to protect Ned? What, you know, is... What the hell is their game, man?
I really don't know. I really don't know. Even having seen this once, I really don't know.
But yeah, and it's no longer a game for two. They say a lot of really cool lines of dialogue, and Arya overhears
yep.
it all, but of course doesn't understand the significance of any of it.
Right. So we go to Varys and Littlefinger in the throne room. Varys is questioning Littlefinger's ethics, I guess, and Littlefinger, his sexual ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And Littlefinger responds by asking if someone keeps his balls in a box. Low blow, Littlefinger.
It's like, and Varys comes right. This is such good verbal sparring. It's so entertaining.
It is.
He goes, oh,
love
you know,
scene.
I don't know where they are, and we had been so close.
Right.
So, like, this is Elam Garrick levels of, you know, from Deep Space Nine to Taylor.
Oh, right, yes.
Like, levels
and Odo.
Of,
yeah.
you don't really start a war with words with him.
Mm-hmm.
But then Littlefinger seemingly beats him. Like, he's got him in, like, hey,
yeah.
I know about your little fucking tunnel visits, and what would the king
right.
think about that? And
which is kind of the ultimate gotcha, because we know how Rob is about Targaryens.
Right, which also drops the hint that Varys is not a native Westerosi, so maybe he
mm-hmm.
can be suspect even more so than the guy like Littlefinger, who's born and bred to the country. And then at the end, you know, just when you think Littlefinger's completely cut his shit off, Varys drops the bomb that he already knows what they're being summoned about, and Littlefinger doesn't.
Right.
So it's like, you think Littlefinger got the upper hand, but then Varys twists the knife at the end.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder whose spies are better.
Right. It's disturbing news from far away. Haven't you heard?
Right.
So entertaining.
It is. Littlefinger is carrying a book that looks a lot like that lineage book. I don't know if it actually is the book, but
right.
looks a lot like the one that Ned was looking at last
episode. Could
last
be his latest numbers on his whoring industry.
It might be. Yeah, could be his books.
Profits up, cost down.
Okay. Although...
Asses up, heads
100,
down.
100 gold for a whore. Mm, the prices are getting inflated there.
Yeah, it's true.
But the Lord, it's whatever the lords are willing to pay, you know?
It's true.
It's the invisible hand of the, economy guiding the whore market.
Yeah, you can really see the disparity between the cost of a whore in King's Landing and Theon's costs up in the north.
Yeah.
It's, man, no wonder Roz is going to
her values just being depressed in that market.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a John's market up there. So Arya exits the dungeons through a cave and tries to walk back in the front gates. Unfortunately, they mistake her for her grungy little face for a beggar girl.
Beggar boy, even.
Right, a beggar boy. She's mistaken twice for a beggar boy in this episode. I love it. They begin insulting her until she tells them, "I'm Arya Stark." Once she's inside, she tells Ned what she overheard. And then Yoren arrives to tell him that Catelyn has taken Tyrion prisoner. Is it Yoren? Yoren calls her a little boy, right?
Yep.
Oh, must be your son. He has the look. She's like, I'm a girl. Love that line. I don't know. What does Ned think about all this stuff? Does he even have the wherewithal to put it together yet?
I think that's the thing. Like, he at first doesn't take Arya seriously, but then when she drops some of these things about the you finding the bastard, he's right. Like that. His ears perk up, but just as he's processing that, Yoren comes in with this pressing news that he has to then process. And you know, yeah. I said that I'm not sure how much Arya understands, but she understands enough to be concerned for her father at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she heard mention of the Hand of the King and
right.
Taking out the second one. So, yeah, she's probably worried.
Right. And the fact that she's comforted by the fact that he's got 50 guards and, you know, Jory is saying that he's not going to let anyone kill Ned. So that makes her feel better.
Yeah. Then the Knights of the Vale meet Catelyn on the road and they accompany her back to the Eyrie. Real short scene there. They're surprisingly antagonistic toward Catelyn here,
right?
For this being her sister, that seems a little weird to me.
What did you, man? I can't tell the Eyrie when we first see it whether it looks cool or too outlandish. Like, it looks like the kind of terrain you'd find in Minecraft when something renders wrong and a mountain's hollow. Like,
right?
Did humans hollow that mountain? Is that a natural formation? Like,
it's got to be natural. Although I don't know. There's a giant ice wall, so
right.
Who knows? Right. But
Brandon Builder was busy 8,000 years ago.
To me, it's like they found the fucked up cave and we're like, oh yeah, we got to do this.
Right, as you do. It's like, oh yeah, I got to build a fort here. This is cool as shit.
Right.
Got a waterfall of lava coming down from it.
Yep.
I'll call it the Moon Door. I don't know. I feel like something I wanted to see because I remember thinking it was awesome, but like Game of Thrones kind of makes its bones by being grounded in the real world and they add a few fantastic things to it. And if everyone's castle looks like something you'd find in Jack and the Beanstalk, I feel like it may be skirting the line a little too close for my tastes.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember if I've said this on the podcast, but I notoriously don't like fantasy stories. And a lot of people said, hey, this is fantasy for people who don't like fantasy. And so I go into this thinking, okay, well, maybe it's more politics and medieval warfare type stuff, which it is. It's a lot of that. But it's real puzzling to me that they started off in the very first scene with a bunch of fantasy.
Mm.
Like, if that was your intention... Maybe they're trying to, you know, plant that flag and say this is fantasy because I know I'm in the minority,
right?
With not liking fantasy stuff.
Well, and also it's still like cool. I mean, they hit you with the ice wall and these rangers and it's all like it's a mystery. And then they just completely go away from it. Like it's been five episodes now, and we haven't heard shit about the White Walkers other than the deserter and people talking about, you know, the wall legends of them. So I feel like that's the thing. Like, you know, who's the person that sees the first 5 minutes of Game of Thrones and says, oh, fuck, they said it was from no fantasy and here's a fucking ice monster. I'm out.
It's like, not
you
me.
At least give it the first episode.
I'm the most likely person to do that.
Sure.
And I didn't do
just
that.
Just out of spite. Just out of spite.
Yeah. Okay, so Ned's informed that the king has requested his presence at the small council meeting, which is surprising because Robert never attends small council meetings.
Get a little familiar with the king there, Jim. That's dangerous.
Rob, I know. I'm giving him
Bobby,
nicknames.
Bobby B.
Robert demands that Viserys, Dany, and her child are all killed. Ned thinks the child is just a rumor, but apparently they're getting their information from Jorah, so they trust it. Ned tries to counsel against killing a child, but Robert, along with his council, his entire council, is set on it.
Especially with the Jorah. I mean, Ned got good reasons here with his Jorah Mormont. So like, oh, right. Well, he's a traitor Jorah. To the realm. Mm-hmm. He's a fugitive from justice. What would this guy say to get back in her? Like, that's all solid points he's making.
It is.
On the other hand, the other people make good points as well, too.
And like, we know that it's true, right? Like... We know this information is reliable. She's
sure.
Or at least Dany thinks this information is true.
Yeah, and that's where kind of real politic comes into play. Like, if you absolutely knew that Hitler was going to grow up to be Hitler, would you be justified in dropping a bomb on his mom's house when she was pregnant with him?
Why? You got to drop a bomb? You're probably going to kill neighbors. I mean, it's not like they...
Okay. You assassinate him with the blow dart. Or assassinate her with a blow dart.
Fair. Good.
We don't very rarely deal in that kind of certainties, you know? Like, no one really knew at the time. So, you know, that way lies a lot of dead mothers, a lot of dead babies, if you just... Anyone you suspect, so...
Right. And it's this fear of some far-flung future where they may or may not be able to come across the sea and take over King's
Landing.
Like,
even if the worst imagine
even
happens.
If she is pregnant.
Yeah.
Like, will they be able to get over here?
Right.
I mean, their entire culture goes against that.
Right. And they have no boats. Like, it's like, you know, saying that the Mongols would invade North America.
Yeah, let's wait until they hear, like, we hear word of them building boats.
It does feel
you know?
Like that, yeah, you would have, like, oh, the Dothraki are trying to acquire a fleet. Okay, now.
Yeah.
Now, but then at that point, maybe it's too late to.
It might be.
Assassinate? I don't know.
I think it's too early at this point. But I do think they should keep an eye on it.
Sure.
And Varys and Littlefinger are both set up to do that. I don't know why they're not. So, anyway, Ned resigns
There's no percentage in going against what the king wants. So,
right.
It's like an open question about what Varys and Littlefinger at this point would think about, like, what they privately think.
What they actually...
Or Maester Pycelle, but it's like, well, I could try to give good counsel, or I could just go with whatever Robert wants, and...
Right, I mean, you go back to the conversations about, well, the king has spent us 6 million crowns into debt, or whatever they're called.
Yeah.
Nobody can tell him no. Mm-mm. And he says that to Ned. You're the only one who could tell me no, right? Like,
right. And even you.
And even you in this case.
Limits, yeah.
Yeah. So he resigns his hand of the king. He's done.
I love Maester Pycelle. I never get tired of hearing him, you know, kiss ass. Like, wouldn't it be wiser? Kinder, even. He's like, I don't know why I made him sign Jimmy Stewart, but
he's turning to Mr. Ed.
Yeah, a cross between Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Ed.
Okay. So Ned begins packing his things and tells Jory to get his daughters ready to leave. Littlefinger comes in and offers to take Ned to the final person that John Arryn spoke with before he died.
Oh, perfect Ned bait.
Yeah, well, he can't resist a mystery.
That's what I'm saying.
He's a...
You could leave now and be safe forever, or...
Right. So he agrees to go and leaves Jory to guard his daughters. And then Catelyn...
But he wants his two best swords. I think he actually told Jory to get your two best swords and kind of come with me.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I thought
he told take four dudes and keep my daughters safe.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure which is actually right there.
But Jory came with him to this clandestine meeting, which is why I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The two best swords in court, but yeah, guard my daughter with whoever the riffraff is left, I guess.
Okay. With the worst we have.
Yeah, she's in the keep. We're going to the streets. I need the best guys with me.
Right. So Catelyn meets with Lysa, who is breastfeeding her far too old to breastfeed son, Robin. Lysa wants to kill Tyrion, but Catelyn won't let him be harmed. Instead, he's thrown into a sky cell.
This is a joke that spoiler people appreciate, but Sir Meryn Trant should have walked into a room and just said, too old.
Okay.
That's all, you know, needed his commentary in this scene.
Instead, he's thrown into a sky cell, which is a cell with only three walls, the fourth side being open to a sheer cliff, which looks like 2,000-foot drop, 10,000-foot drop. It's insane.
And it's funny because, like, I poo-pooed the castle, but the Sky Cells, like, I remember when I saw these and read them in the books, like, that's fucking genius.
This is the coolest idea I've ever seen.
Yeah. Like, in the books, they make it, I don't know if they actually show this in the series or not, but in the books, the floors are actually slightly slanted towards the bottomless edge.
Right. They make mention of it here.
Okay. Okay. Because I know they make a point of, like, Tyrion... you know, being uneasy in the cell, but I wasn't sure if they actually called it out.
Yeah, spoiler alert, it happens next episode.
And they make mention. Yeah, and he falls to his death, and that's the end of Tyrion Lannister.
Yep.
Boom, we just ruined it. We ruined the next episode for
No,
you.
He soars down, he opens his robes, and he soars down.
Oh, for guys, when we find out that he can fly like a squirrel, like a flying squirrel.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's got flaps of skin between his ankles and wrists.
We warned you this was a fantasy show, right?
But yeah, and we're not quite there yet. But yeah, like that's the thing. And the whole time Kat just has this face of regret, like, oh my God, Liza, you're insane. Your son is insane. This is all gross. You think John Arryn's talking about your weak ass son being a seed of strong. Like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah. This kid is just the worst.
He is pretty, anytime you want to hate on Sansa, remember this universe also includes Sweet Robin.
Right. I don't know what else to say about that. We move on to Loras shaving all of the hair off Renly's body while Renly complains.
He does leave him an armpit.
Oh, that's right. He does only shave that one armpit, doesn't he?
Yeah, he got all hot and bothered with the blood talk.
I guess so. Renly's complaining that everyone thinks he's not tough enough. Renly mentions that Robert's taking him on a hunt since he can't joust. Robert's got his blood up. He wants some fresh blood.
Sure.
Loras says he should be king instead of Robert and then cuts him to get him used to seeing blood, I guess his own blood. Is this like foreshadowing? Hey, dude, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then once Renly is dolphin smooth, Loras goes down on him.
Half dolphin smooth. A couple things. Like, I took a lot of this as gratuitous, talking about being a master swordsman or gifted swordsman, driving spears into flesh. Like, there's a lot of homoeroticism just on top of the blatant homoeroticism. Like,
fair.
What is this show trying to do? And then I love this show because when Loras hits the floor, there's fairly graphic dick sucking sounds,
right?
That you can like, and they linger like
on
Renly's
face, and just
yes, Game of Thrones, go there, why not?
Yeah, I mean, they go there with the women. I'm fine with them going there with the men, right?
No,
I mean,
I'm always for equality in these things. I just think like. You know, it'd be funny to, because you could do a lot of YouTube cuts with, like, you know, just cut right through, you know, and like, what could you underlay under this?
Sure.
You know, some kind of hydraulic action sounds. Like,
he's got a fuck machine down there? What's
he's a
happening?
Gifted swordsman. All right. You know, he knows how to spear lances into flesh. What do you want from him?
Apparently so. Into his own flesh? Does he spear himself in the mouth?
It's, you know, he's wherever the spear needs to be thrust.
Okay.
He's ready to go.
Yeah, but we get, you know, Loras is like, hey, you should be king.
Yeah.
I don't feel like that's possible, but
he's
I don't know.
What
line. Do you think? What do you think about Renly at this point as a king? I know he's not, you know, there's a big point about him not being tough. But that's kind of what Robert is, and I don't know that it's a great thing for the realm necessarily.
Right. Right.
He's a warrior, whereas Renly might be a little more of a thinker.
Yeah, and also, you know, he actually cares about what people think, which can be good and bad in a leader. I mean, that's a great question. You know, who would be the best king in Westeros is a great question,
right.
And it doesn't seem like there's ever a perfect answer because, you know, you're right. You need multiple qualities of, you know, you need to be tough, and in this universe, you need to have kind of martial skill usually, and it's just hard to find those warrior philosopher kings that can sit on the throne for decades and decades and steer the land into peace and prosperity, especially. When you're rolling genetic dice every couple of every generation.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that king was great. He was the warrior philosopher king. His son's a real fucking asshole.
Sure. And it also depends a lot on the people around you, right? The small council doesn't seem to be steering Rob in any kind of direction.
Sure,
just letting him do what he wants.
You get a noble lord decides he wants to be ambitious all of a sudden. You can rule as justly and fairly as you want, and the realm's still going to bleed. So
sure.
What do you do?
Yeah. So Cersei goes to Robert to talk about Ned's resignation and the, kind of the politics of the Seven Kingdoms, like the Dothraki, what if they attack? Robert lays out the scenario where they hide behind their castle walls and everybody gets angry. Apparently the only thing holding the kingdoms together at this point is their marriage.
Which their genuine laughter at that is great.
Right. Because it's such a ridiculous concept. Like, they don't even like each other.
No, right. And it's the only thing holding the realm. Which kind of also is commentary, if you're paying attention to, like, you know, I mean, obviously it's Game of Thrones. It's not, you know, a cakewalk. Mm-hmm. So it's not a spoiler to admit to say that some shit's coming. But if this is the only thing holding the realm together and you see how fragile it is, that should give you pause. Like, oh, wow. Okay, well, the realm's, you know, is in dire shape.
Yeah.
This is duct tape. It needs at least baling wire.
And, you know, we find out kind of one of the big things that's getting between them, or that used to anyway, that did at the start, is they talk candidly about their relationship and Lyanna Stark for the first time.
Yeah.
Which is a good moment for Rob here. I mean, it's a good moment for both of them. I love this scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. Robert just holds this flame for Lyanna.
And that's the thing.
And
he doesn't...
Cersei has kind of resented it, and she's fought against it, and now she's just kind of accepted it. And it's been 17 years, and they're finally getting around to talking about it.
Yeah, and you know, a question like on Robert's mind is why.
Right.
And she says it's because there's, you know, what harm could she do to our relationship at this point? Which, you know,
fair
point.
Mm-hmm.
And he's even saying, like, you know, I don't... He's holding this flame, but for a person that you don't even know or recognize anymore. And which, you know, in cultures before you had the photograph, I wonder what that would be like. Like, if you're an adult and you lose a child,
right,
and then you're like a 70-year-old man, can you remember what the child looked like?
Yeah,
because it's, you know, in our, and you know, we've got pictures and we got videos and you got memories and all that.
Right.
I wonder if that was a real thing. Like, shit, that was 17 years ago. I couldn't even draw you a picture of what she looked like. And yet I still love this idea of her.
Yeah, I mean, that's true of all memory. So, yeah, if you don't have the reminders that we have, I imagine everything gets fuzzy.
But, you know, I was also, because I ran into this thought experiment as I was taking my notes, and I'm like, okay, I remember I had a crush on a girl in the second grade. Yeah, I still remember what Ashley looks like. So, maybe this is just, then again, I haven't spent the last 17 years whoring and drinking myself into an early grave.
That's true.
Drinking, sure. not as much whoring as you might think. So maybe just him being...
Yeah.
Killing his brain with alcohol every day, is that supposed to be a character trait? Or?
But I don't know if it's this way for you, but for me, I remember like the rough outlines of things. Mm. I don't remember the details of
it
a
is
lot
weird.
Of things.
It's like, it's almost like a even peripheral vision. Like,
yeah.
I can,
yeah,
if I close my eyes, I can think, but it's you're right. Like, if I had to draw from it, of course, you know, that's questions my skills of an artist, but
sure.
I don't know. It's, the memory is a funny thing. It's like, if you try to look right at it, it turns to smoke. But if you just think in generalities, like, okay, yeah, I could definitely, like, I could pick these people out of a lineup.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
All right, we go
idle
to
thought.
We go to Ned, who's talking with a girl who has a bastard by the king, and he asks her what John Arryn wanted, because this is the final person John Arryn spoke with, and he just wanted to know that the boy was healthy and happy. Ned leaves.
I believe it's
her.
A girl.
Is it?
Yeah, because he says the girl will want for nothing at the end of the scene.
Oh, okay. Then it's a girl. Ned leaves this other girl, because this woman is very young. She looks...
Bobby B, still...
Real young.
Still, the seed is strong.
Yeah, I guess. So Ned leaves her, and he asks Littlefinger why John Arryn would want to visit all of Robert's bastards before he died. And when he leaves, Ned's confronted by Jaime, who has found out about Tyrion being taken. When Jaime tries to take Ned prisoner, they fight. Ned is wounded, and Jaime spares his life rather than kill him dishonorably.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting things in this. Like, Ned propounds a Littlefinger, like, why would John Arryn track them all down? And Littlefinger's got a sensible explanation. Like, well, maybe Robert got sentimental and wanted them all taken care of. Like, I could see Robert crying in his cup of wine one night and like, oh, I got all this, I don't even know how many kids. Find them all, John. Let's make sure they all got a college education.
Right.
Then he goes back to doing whatever he's doing.
Put a copper in their pocket.
What do you mean Jory getting all caught up in the boobies? I did not like that characterization of him.
I don't care about Jory. Jory's a nothing to me.
Well, he's dead, but
like, he's just
first
a
of all,
dude
fuck
who's
you.
There to protect Ned. I have no connection to Jory.
What I'm saying is it brought me out of, like, I was into this scene, and then Jory's sitting there doing the, like, you know, wolf head, mouth flopping on the floor, tongue rolling out, aug, in front of his lord.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't, you know, again, Ross lives right outside your castle, dude. Did you have a couple coppers in your pocket? Like, why, what is the deal?
Maybe not. Maybe he's got other...
You're on the clock, man. You're on the clock. Yeah. And you Northerners, I was led to believe, are above this kind of shit, so... on to the scene we probably want to spend the most time talking about.
The fight?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty good fight.
So you think that this was them both going all out?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I'm not either, to tell you the truth. Yeah. And because Ned's pissed and he's fighting for what he thinks is his life.
Right.
Whereas I don't think Jaime thinks he's in any real serious harm here.
You don't think so? I mean, the right sword slash can take him out before his guards can jump in.
He also wasn't wearing his armor. He was just there in his like leather jerkin under armor shit.
Yeah, that's true.
So I feel like that if you think about that, like, Jaime really wanted a fight on fair footing. And
yeah, he knew Ned wouldn't have armor either.
Would he kill Ned?
That's the thing. I don't think that he can kill Ned here. He's probably got to disable him the way that it... Not in the way that
the
it happened,
if you kill
but
Ned, then that's done. Yeah. Like, you can definitely, you know, hobble him or whatever, but if he dies, then you have escalated this already kind of crazy situation.
Right. So I don't think there's any way he wants to kill him here. So maybe he's not going all out, because if you're going all out in a fight, you come to kill the person.
And, you know, Ned does acquit himself pretty well. He's pretty badass. So is Jaime. And then Jory takes a dagger through the eye.
Right. How much of that do you think Ned knows? Does Ned realize, okay, Jaime
all
can't really kill me here? Because Ned seems a little thick sometimes.
I don't know. I don't know, but he stands behind this. Other thing is, he stands behind his wife's decision.
Right. Like, he claims it as his own.
He doesn't like, because he could have. He could have been like, look, she's impetuous. What do you want? I'll work with you. We'll
figure this out.
Yeah. I'll call her on the Descartes, but he backs her play. Says, you know, even though it's certainly a gun jumping moment, he's like, no, it's my command.
Also, I feel like he doesn't respect Jaime. We've seen them at each other's throats.
Right.
Since the beginning, he this Mad King thing. Yeah. Ned just doesn't feel like this guy has honor. So, I don't know.
He's certainly not going to throw his wife under the bus in front of Jaime.
Yeah,
but I don't know. And I remember Jaime killing the guy that stabbed Ned, but I guess he just punched him in the face.
Yeah, which bashes him.
That actually tells me something interesting about Jaime, that he is a little bit more measured than maybe we would suspect of a guy throwing 8-year-olds out of buildings.
Right.
But you can tell that's really pissed Jaime off, because he was having a good time for who knows how long. This guy robbed him of his plaything. I think of this is in light of what Jory told Arya about, don't worry about your father, he's well protected. Well, then the head of the household guard and his two best swords just got cut down.
Right.
So,
and they kind of accost him just there in the street, and Littlefinger shouts, I'll bring the city watch, and runs away. Whether he's actually going to bring the city watch, I don't know.
And here's the interesting thing. Who dropped dime on Ned? It's either Varys or Littlefinger, and they both, because Varys put him up to the visit. Mm-hmm. Littlefinger, it was at his whorehouse. Were they working together? Is one of them? Did someone just, you know, one of the many spies in the city just happen to see Ned going into this brothel?
Right. Honestly, it could be either of them.
It might even be
Cersei's spies.
That's what I'm saying. Right. You're right.
So I'm not sure at this point, but you get the impression that, you know, Jaime has some kind of honor, and that what he did here at the end by stabbing him in the leg was dishonorable.
Right.
And I wonder if Ned will realize that and have any more respect for Jaime. after this incident. Probably not, because he got stabbed in the leg and he tried to kill him.
And he killed all his men for no good damn reason either. Right. That's the other thing.
But we as an audience get the impression that maybe they're more alike than they think.
Yeah, but there's also important differences. Like, I don't think Jamie knows the names of any of these fuckers. Whereas Ned, like Jory, you know,
of the men he's killing?
Yeah. No, I don't think Jamie knows the name of the men who rode up with him. They're Lannister dudes.
Okay, right.
But, like, you know, Jory's lived in his castle. He probably remembers when he was born. His father's Roderick, the guy with the crazy sideburns. Like, there's loyalty, and you know, Jory knows his men, and who's the, like, in an instant, like, who's your best two swordsmen? He pauses for, like, a half second and rattles them off. As a difference between, and they even show, like, the Lannister guys are essentially stormtroopers. They don't, their masks cover their face. So, that's why this show is so great. It does a lot of character work with just costuming and stuff that you get what do you call that? That's all subtextual things that kind of come loud and clear just by watching it.
Yeah. And a lot of that work it has to do, because if you tried to put everything in the text, this would be nonstop exposition and still really confusing.
We would still be halfway through season three, probably.
Yeah. So
the epic 77 episode season three.
All right, well, that's it for this episode. We've got only 76 left in the season.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel Shogun into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, before we get to feedback, just want to let you know how you can support us, because that's important. We wouldn't be doing this podcast, especially here in the off season, going back and doing a rewatch of all things, if we weren't able to do this as a full-time gig. And our full-time gig is essentially giving you guys and gals what you want. So for as little as 100 gold dragons, you can go to
club. How much is that?
Is that a lot or a little?
I feel like that's not a lot.
Should I do it? Should I just go with the standard US conversion?
Yes, please.
For as little as $1 US a month, you can sign up for club.baldmove.com. You get a bunch of extra features. You get an extra bunch of content. You get ad-free feeds. You get VIP access to our forums. Tons of stuff for a little bit of dough. And the most important thing is it keeps us in the business of making these podcasts, which, assuming you enjoy them, is a net good thing also for you. If you don't have the inclination to join a club, I know a lot of you people are loners, they're rebels, they're hedge knights out there in the cold hard frontier making their way. They don't got dollars. They're gonna be dollars and clubs. What the hell? You might find your way to Amazon underneath one of them hedges. You go to Amazon.baldmove.com and it's awesome. It's magical. We get free money for you shopping on Amazon, and it doesn't cost you anything. It's not like they're earmarking, you know, when you go to the driver's license and they're like, oh, do you want to contribute $3 to Prez? Fuck those presidents. You go to PetSmart, do you want to do a doll for homeless? Fuck those homeless pets.
Homeless pets?
None of this. It's just free money. You don't have to check shit. You just go to Amazon.
Is every animal on the face of the planet a homeless pet?
Well, my cat.
Other than the ones
that
are in people's houses.
My cat is happily housed. It's apartment.
But like a giraffe in the Serengeti, is it a homeless pet?
They're freaking. So you okay. Go to amazon.baldmove.com and we get a teeny tiny cut of whatever's in your cart when you check out. You don't get charged nothing. We just get free money. It's a pretty awesome deal for sending you to Amazon.
And Jeff Bezos will come and shave your chest.
Yes. That's
personally.
That's,
and one armpit.
That might be part of the new prime.
I think it is. Okay. But they're upping the price.
Well worth the, what is it, 79 now?
It's 100.
100 gold
Maybe
dragons.
Maybe 130. It's going up.
It's 100 gold dragons. That gets you to one armpit.
Right.
150 gold dragons.
He gives you a taste.
You get the undercarriage. You get the undercarriage and the other armpit. Amazon.baldmove.com, club.baldmove.com. Pick one and support us, please.
Do we have some feedback to do?
We do have some feedback. And I just want to stress that, you know, we have been recording these kind of at the same time as releasing, but because of our schedules, we're doing two today. We're doing 105 and 106 together. I've tried my best to split out the feedback accordingly. Mm-hmm. But if you send us an email over the next week or two to respond, it probably will not be considered until we get to episode 107. So don't think that I've ignored it or not. We'll probably have a supersized email for that. Feedback for 105, The Wolf and the Lion, right? That's what this is called?
Yeah.
If you want to send feedback, it's gameofthrones@baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com. Graham H. said, last week you guys wondered why Cersei's name wasn't Baratheon instead of Lannister, and I think I may have the answer. The likely case is that you can't marry into the royal family. Well, you can marry a member of the royal family, but you can't inherit their name. So that's like difference. That's the difference between like... Catelyn Stark calls herself Catelyn Stark. And this, So
it only applies to the king?
Yes,
or the queen?
Here's why. You can't marry into the royal line. You can have royal children, but, like, Cersei cannot ever be queen. She is not in the line of succession. She can never be queen in her own right, the way Queen Elizabeth is.
What if everybody in the Lannister and Baratheon families died, except for Cersei?
Well, if she's the last person alive on the throne, I mean, like I'm
Does
saying...
Does she become
like,
the queen?
I mean, there
because
could
then
be...
Because just give her the name.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, these rules of succession and how incestuous these great families are... Eventually, I'm sure she might be 174th person in line for the throne in her own right.
She's like President Rosalind.
But we talked about that.
In Battlestar Galactica.
You know, like Queen Elizabeth is married. We talked about this last season. Queen Elizabeth is married to a gentleman who, if Queen Elizabeth died, he's no longer the king. He doesn't become king. No, it's her sons that do.
Right.
So that's
right.
Why she keeps her surname, because she's not Cersei Baratheon. She cannot sit on the throne in her own right. So, okay. And I guess this is all taken from medieval, you know, like George Martin just cribbed it. And they never really explained this in the books, but no, that's the way it works. Yeah, and that's the way it works in England.
Okay. I am completely ignorant of how monarchies work.
I didn't either. And I got probably 15 or so people giving me that same answer. And I actually did some research after it. It corroborated with what they told me. So that's the answer.
I want to say that makes sense, but it doesn't.
Well,
whatever.
Right. It makes as much sense as a divine right to rule people does in any kind of circumstance. Anyway, Glenn from Seattle played the name game from last episode, Bastards, Cripples, and Broken Things. We said we kind of struggled with the broken things part.
Maybe Theon, that's all I can think, is he's a little fucked up in the head.
Glenn has the opinion that the Night's Watch is the main broken thing. There's not enough men, infighting, recruits that can't survive training, aging leadership, etc. Also, maybe the Hound, too, at least him and his brother's relationship. Speaking of which, the Targaryen-Dothraki relationships are all broken. Brother, sister, Cal, Khaleesi, they're all headed down the wrong direction. I thought, you know, we like playing the name game. Those are all good candidates, especially the Night's Watch. It does seem like, especially last episode, it was a broken institution. That's all the feedback we got for 105. We do have a bunch of spoilers to talk about.
Okay. So we always do that after the music.
We do. And today is the exception. We're going to do it right now. today is no exception. If you got feedback, send it to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com or on forums.baldmove.com, and we will see you in the spoiler section for some well-reasoned and interesting questions and answers and discussion, I'm sure.
And if you don't want spoilers, tune out now. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. Bye.
And we're back with the spoiler section. Do you want to talk a little bit about Cersei insisting on Lancel as Robert's squire?
We can start with that.
That's a little suspicious.
So
with what we know,
that's
of
the
his
thing
death
with what
and,
we know.
Yeah,
because I'm always trying to think, because I came in the first two seasons relatively spoiler free, and I kind of remember my reaction, and I never thought, like, to me this is just nepotism. This is like, well, of course she forced one of her cousins to be the squire to the king, because that's probably the even though Robert's being a complete asshole, that's probably a fast track to knighthood.
Yeah.
And knighthood is the fast track to, you know, distinguishing yourself and getting, you know, a keep and lands of your own and all that stuff.
Yep.
But yeah.
Also, I know in the books there's a lot of talk of them having a relationship of their own. Yeah.
Lancel and Cersei?
Cersei and Lancel, yeah.
Open question about whether that started back here or whether that just was when Jaime went away.
Okay.
Because Jaime goes fugitive in the next episode and doesn't really come back until, shit, his arm's cut off and...
Is that even a thing in the show?
What?
Her and Lancel?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. It must
Tyrion
have happened in seasons
leverage,
1 through 3.
And, yeah, it happens in season... I believe it all happens in season 2.
Okay.
Because
I don't remember
and
any of
Tyrion
it.
Kind of go head-to-head, and, of course, Tyrion
of course,
handles
yeah.
her. One thing I want to talk about is this talk of Lyanna. Because Robert's like, why are we talking about her now? And I'm like, why now indeed? Do you think this was... My interpretation is Cersei knows exactly what's going to happen now. She's got the plan. It's already in motion. She knows King Robert's going to die. This is just her satisfying an idle curiosity.
Okay.
Like it's essentially her getting closure with Robert, and he has no idea.
Right.
But I thought the second time, you know, watching this again, that really was added an extra level of... Not poignancy, because I think at this point Cersei's over Robert, but just a little bit of spice to the scene, because you know that this is her essentially extracting information from his brain before she's going to kill him.
Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff in here with... there's a nice little point here with Arya being referred to as a boy, because we know later on she does cut her hair and intentionally try to look like a boy.
Sure, yeah.
So good little... bit of foreshadowing there. And finally, this last scene, last thing I really wanted to talk about, when Ned is fighting Jaime.
If you ask me who's the better swordsman, I'm walking out right now.
I'm not going to ask you that. Littlefinger shouts, I'm going to go get the city watch. And he runs off. And we question, you know, who tipped off Jamie about Ned's location. You really get the impression, knowing what we know about next episode or episode 8, that Littlefinger probably tipped him off.
I think so, too.
Because we know Littlefinger eventually stabs Ned in the back.
Yes.
Or, you know, puts the knife to his throat.
Sure.
So he must... I guess he's running away. He wants Ned to think that he just didn't get there in time.
Right. Accelerating the war between the wolf and the lion does not play into Varys' endgame. Now, granted, we don't know what his endgame is, but we're far enough along to know it involved Dany.
Right.
And it's like, that's the other thing, cool, interesting thing is, like, man, they really, this shit was all laid bare on episode 5.
Shockingly. Yeah. I couldn't believe when I heard them talking to each other. Knowing what we know about season 6 or even 5,
mm-hmm.
That holy shit, Varys is already planning this stuff from the beginning.
Yep,
and I don't necessarily know why. Like, why is Varys so aboard this Dany train?
That is, you know, that's still the open question about whether he's truly for the realm, whether this is some kind of giant conspiracy theory. I mean, if you're a new fan. I actually talked there's a, if you go to the spoiler archives, you can find, which I'll post in the show notes. I haven't been doing it of late because I haven't been doing the spoiler stuff of late.
Right.
But there's a whole bunch of various theories about, you know, what is him and Illyrio's long con. And you don't find out until the book of Dance of Dragons, where Tyrion goes across the Narrow Sea and he spends some time with Illyrio, and Illyrio talks about the scams that him and Varys, that, you know, they're old chums from like, way back, and the scams they used to run on the rich nobility of Essos. And there, my favorite theory is that essentially what they used to do is Varys would break into a rich person's house and steal like their Valyrian steel sword or the family pendant or the cup or whatever the fuck that they have of value, their oldest painting or tapestry. And then Illyrio was a swordsman, and he would be like, I know the brigand and where he, like, and I'll go, and he go, and so...
I'll take it back for a reward, yeah.
Yeah, and they essentially double dip on it. Right. And then Varys realized that, like, screw the baubles, what's the real money is stealing their ledgers and their diaries and their private records and their secrets. And then we could extort them. And the most popular theory is essentially that this... con is something that they did, you know, kind of writ large, that Varys stole the Seven Kingdoms from the Targaryens and is now selling it back to them at what, like, you know, what is his price that's going to be paid? I don't know. But that's like my favorite working theory is that this is essentially the exact same con, only on a continental scale.
So he's working Illyrio now at this point?
No, him and Illyrio are still like... You know, that's the thing. Illyrio had, he was the one that
So he's not actually that loyal to Dany or to Viserys.
Under this theory.
Which I could see it.
Yeah.
Because he kind of thinks Viserys is a dumbass anyway.
Right. And, you know, the thing is why? Because Varys had already lit. How much further can Varys climb above Master of Secrets on the Small Council?
Well, he can be at the right hand of the queen who's coming back to take the throne.
Sure, he could be the hand of the queen, but but the thing is like, my gut tells me that Varys is kind of true blue, which I could be. I could totally be Ned Starking this right now. I could totally be fucking this up, but I've heard him talk enough that I kind of do feel like that his side is with the common man. So that directly conflicts with the theory that I like the most, which is essentially they're just extorting this for their own personal gain. I don't know. I guess why not both? Why can't they be making moves that enrich themselves and line their pockets and give them power and influence that also is better for the kingdom? Because obviously the Mad King was terrible. Robert Baratheon was terrible.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Joffrey's terrible.
Well, and the other thing is in the books, there's the added complication that Varys and Illyrio are not trying to help Dany so much as they're trying to supplant their own boy, this Aegon Targaryen that claims to be the baby that was spirited away at the last moment, and he's the true heir to the throne.
He's not got a better claim really than mentioned Danny. In the show.
Never
all.
Mentioned in the show. Like, so.
Yeah.
So we talked last week about what is the Archduke Ferdinand moment.
Right.
And I said, well, maybe it's Tyrion being captured. What about Jaime's attack on Ned?
Because, that's a pretty strong one, yeah.
You know, the way it worked out, Tyrion is going to be released next episode on his own steam anyway. If Jaime does not stab the Hand of the King, who's not technically the Hand of the King right now, and then go run off. And Tywin's also, we find out next episode, doing some fuckery. He's like starting to apply pressure to the Riverlands. You know,
right. It just makes me think there is no powder keg moment. It's not like, I mean, you just see all these dominoes gradually getting bigger and bigger.
So you're in that school of thought.
And when you push the tiny one over.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. It's just like World War I. Cascades. There's a certain point where it's inevitable.
Right.
You know, but it still doesn't stop people from trying to find that inciting event.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a fool's errand, mostly. Okay.
The other one I want to talk about is the fact that this Gregor is my favorite the Mountain. He's been recast three times.
Is it the goatee and the...
Well, here's the thing. The new Mountain physically is impressive and awesome. But do you buy him as the Hound's older brother? He looks like...
Not as much as I do this guy.
This guy looks like the Hound's fucking older brother. Uh-huh. And his name, I think his real name's Conan something or other, so that's fucking cool.
Well,
I mean, the current Mountain is called like...
No wonder
Thor.
He chops
his
head off.
His last name literally means like Thor's hammer, so that's pretty cool too, or son of Thor.
Yeah.
But I feel like this guy, he's got the size, he's got the bestial qualities, he's got the... Looks like he's got a little bit of salt and pepper, and he's grizzled, and he could be...
That's the thing, like...
I mean, season two, the beanpole who rides, that's the worst Mountain.
My girlfriend and I were watching this together, and she was like, the hound looks fucking tiny. And I'm like, well, the Hound's actually pretty big. You're just looking at him through the lens of the Mountain.
Yeah.
Who is a fucking Mountain.
Like, and like in the show, he's huge. And
because the Hound is not small.
No.
But you get,
he's
you
like
get the 6'4",
6'5". Gregor's right. Supposed to be like 7 foot tall.
And he is. Yeah. Like,
I don't know
if
this
huge.
Guy's... I know that the current Mountain
the world's
is like
strong
6'8",
man
or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, this guy's my favorite. And I know that... I never got a straight answer about why they recast him. Some people said that he was difficult to work with.
He just kept chopping the heads off those horses.
Right. PETA.
Yeah.
PETA got on him. Like, you can't do that, man. I've heard that he had a scheduling conflict, that he was filming like another fantasy series.
That's got to be the worst. If you're casting Game of Thrones and you're like, well, I got this other thing... I don't know if Game of Thrones is going to be huge. And then six seasons later, you're like, God damn it, I could have been the Mountain.
Right. The Beanpole Mountain was in like 30 seconds worth of scenes in season two.
Right.
And then you didn't see the Mountain until season five. So I'm not even saying he made a bad decision. It's just a damn shame because I still think this is the best Mountain. Apologies to the current one, which you're perfectly serviceable. If you were born 15 years ago, you'd have been probably the best Mountain. But you just baby-faced, man. You're baby-faced. You know, Zombie Mountain now, I think from here on out, it's like plausible that he could be older than the Hound because he's just fucked up and gross. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Too baby-faced, Mountain. Should we get the feedback?
Sure.
All right. Spoiler feedback. Thomas T is up first. Could Thoros of Myr have sacrificed King's blood to the Red God? We hear that he's the first one through the gates at the Siege of Pyke. He's wielding a flaming sword, and two of the other self-styled Kings of the Iron Islands, Balon Greyjoy's sons, died defending Pyke. Could Thoros have killed one with his flaming sword, thus inadvertently sacrificing King's blood to R'hllor?
Oh, God, you're talking about a lot of stuff I have no clue about.
Okay, so I think this is a beginning of a crackpot theory, which I love.
I know what the siege on Pyke is.
Okay, right?
It's kind of the defining, the finishing blow for...
The Greyjoy Rebellion.
Right, and the Baratheons taking the throne.
No. So Robert's Rebellion happens like 17 years ago. The Greyjoy Rebellion happened about 9 years ago.
Oh, okay. So this was after Robert was king.
It was. And Ned Stark led the forces against them. But... We see they're talking about war stories, and they're talking about Thoros of Myr, who we meet later on, who brings back, you know,
Beric Dondarrion, who we meet next episode.
By the way, my least favorite Beric.
I was going to say, they must have recast him,
shit,
too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this all guy right. was just a grip they had, and like, hey, wear this cloak and look
serious.
Because
he's too baby-faced.
Oh, I mean, my God.
The Barrick they bring back later.
He looks like the second lead developer on the latest version of id Software's Doom or something, you know? Right. He's like John Carmack's son. But I feel like that, I don't feel like this is a fact. So we know from the last episode that they were reminiscing about Thoros of Myr storming the gates. He had his flaming sword. Thomas is speculating that you have royal blood here, the sons of Balon Greyjoy. They died. If he killed them, not accidentally, but coincidentally, is that what charged him up so that he could bring Beric Dondarrion back?
Maybe.
Which isn't, I mean, that's one of these, I don't think that's a falsifiable theory. It's a cool thing to think about.
It ties in with what we see in season 6 with the sacrifice of Shireen, you know?
Right, like, and that's in season 5 that came, you know, it's arguable that the sacrifice of Shireen is what powered up Melisandre to bring back Jon.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, you could also say she shot her load making the snow melt, too. This shit's all debatable, and again, I don't think any of it's falsifiable.
She could have done that with a hairdryer. I feel like you don't need magic to get that shit done.
Sure. But I honestly did some research to see if this was a popular theory. I couldn't find anything anywhere. Not on the A Song of Ice and Fire subreddit. I couldn't find anything in
original
the Citadel. Yeah. Again, it's unfalsifiable.
Right, but it does kind of line up with
some
other theories.
Yeah, he's got this king's blood charged. He's stored for 10 years, and he blows it right back in Beric Dondarrion, and bam, he comes back to life.
What about the other 8 times?
Yeah, exactly. That's the other problem with the theory.
Yeah.
Brian H., quick question. Why in 7 hells does Dany excommunicate Jorah for spying, and yet the guy he's reporting to, Varys, is now one of her most trusted advisors? Did I miss something, or does Dany simply not know Varys was involved?
Whoa. He wasn't excommunicated for spying. He was excommunicated for selling people into slavery.
No. He was definitely executed or excommunicated. Well, no. So you're conflating two events. He was excommunicated. Okay. Whew. There's a lot of stuff to unpack here.
Okay.
A lot of people think he's because someone called him the Knight in Exile. He's not exiled. He was condemned to death.
Right. It's self-exile.
And he did the Roland Polanski thing of like, yep, I'm going to go flee across the ocean rather than face justice in my native country.
Right.
So that's the one thing. Later on, Dany literally exiles him when she finds out that he at one point was spying.
Well,
on
she
her.
Spied on Jorah. Spied on her. Like, there's a difference between having a network of spies at your command,
right,
and being directly spied on.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a level of trust. Like, Varys was acting in his ordained position of master of secrets serving the rightful king in his eyes to do the direct these efforts. Jorah befriended them, got close to their family, gave her, you know, ingratiated himself to him, and then deliberately betrayed her trust.
Right.
So I think that's the thing.
Although, like, he has done some, you know, Varys brings a gift in Tyrion, and like, Jorah kind of gave her a gift. He saves her life next episode, or in episode 8, which I don't know.
I'm starting to. So you've
all
watched ahead, you son of a bitch.
I have.
That's
so Jorah's tried to make up for it. He just, you know,
he's kind of getting there.
I think he kind of got there.
Yeah, but like, that's the thing. Like, I feel like that. You know, he had a change of heart. Now Varys is more interesting because it's, you know, with the Aegon plot, it's easy to square the fact that he would be fine setting in motion a plot to kill Dany. Because in the next episode, when she tries to get poisoned, Varys, probably, he's the spy master. He put that in motion, and it would have worked had Jorah not, at the last minute, not had the stomach for it, because he's in love with Dany. So, if without Aegon...
Right. So, what the hell is going on in the show?
I just think there's a couple things I think that the Double D's rewrote some stuff to make it more simple and to make the characterizations more strong and straightforward.
But in the process, they fucked it up?
But if you really think about it in isolation, it's like, that doesn't make sense. Because, again, Varys put in plan of motion that would absolutely have worked had it not been for Jorah turning traitor.
Right.
So, in the books, it makes sense because he's back in Aegon, not Dany. And maybe he'll have a change of heart when Aegon gets
exposed
or whatever.
And he's actually trying to delay? Like, he wants to keep this kid from being born so that they won't come over on their boats? Or
yeah,
or
like
I think
in
the
books,
like,
he would not mind killing Dany because he thinks Aegon's the rightful.
Right.
And there's other conspiracy theories that Varys... One of these days, there's going to be an episode where I bring you into some of the crazier theories. But there's a theory that Varys is actually a woman, not a eunuch, and he's the wife of Illyrio.
Oh,
and they're
Jesus.
Trying to put their own son on the throne, which makes a certain amount of sense.
Okay.
If you buy the fact that Varys is just a portly, maybe less conventionally attractive woman and not a eunuch.
Do they do the flashback, or it's not even a flashback, it's him finally catching the guy who took his cock and balls?
That's just a show
book?
Invention.
Okay. All right, well, that kind of says, it puts the kibosh on that
yeah.
idea.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, you could have some pretty big diversions in plot, but it seems like the double Ds just try to just smooth it. Like, don't think to, because, you know, this week's the first time I've had this thought of, like, wait a second. That makes sense if he's back in Aegon, but if he's trying to poison Dany, which is his girl all along, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Because it's not like he told Jorah, I'm just kidding about this. Mm-hmm. Jorah, yeah, so, anyway, I feel like we've covered that enough. But yeah, I feel like there's a couple instances where, just like this thing we're about to talk about, we talked about Robert and Cersei, like this fact that makes no sense, them having a baby that Ned and Kat would know nothing about.
Right, right.
You could have them have a baby and Kat would be like, oh, that's right, I've forgotten in my own grief. But she says, I didn't realize. How the fuck would the queen get pregnant and have a baby that would be announced and the bells would ring and then later dies and they never, it only makes sense if, I mean, I allow that because otherwise if Lena Headey was brought on to just play book Cersei, that'd be like giving the Stig a Ferrari and telling him to keep it under 30. Like, why? Right. Why? Like, give her something that she can sink her teeth in. Give her some juice. They very much made her a three-dimensional character just so she can kind of strut her stuff. And I'm fine with that.
Me too. I think the book Cersei is boring.
But the book purist would be like, well, this is stupid because it doesn't make sense, and therefore the whole thing's terrible. So.
Sure.
Anyway, moving on to Heidi J. Maggie basically says Cersei will have three blonde... this is another one. This is another reason why they fucked with the plot and it doesn't make sense. Heidi J. Maggie the Woods Witch, in her famous prophecy, basically says Cersei will have three blonde children whom she will outlive. I always put a lot of stock in Game of Thrones prophecies, but after listening to the Rewatch podcast and the discussion around Cersei's alleged first child with Robert, I'm wondering, did Maggie the Frog miss this birth just as the Starks did? Am I putting too much faith in prophecy, or is this a plot hole? I feel like it's got to be a plot hole.
Yeah.
Because the prophecy is like, oh, you know, he'll have 6 and 10 children, and you'll have 3. Gold will be their hair, and gold will shrouds. Well... that's all well and good if all of Robert's babies are bastards, but if he had a legitimately born one with Cersei, then, well, there's one that will not live to 1 year old
better.
And it doesn't count.
Right. Sounds better in a prophecy. 3 children, gold in their hair, or whatever.
Right. But again, this awesome scene with Cersei and the king is not in the books, and I think the series is richer for it, so I will conveniently overlook this plot hole.
All right.
So there you go. Robert N., I had some input on discussion you had about why Sam was sent to the Night's Watch instead of the Citadel. I think there are several reasons. One, it's probably more honorable in Randall Tarly's eyes to have his son be part of the Night's Watch defending the realm from Snarks and Grumpkins than to be a soft, fat maester reading books. Two, Randall Tarly is just a dick, and the deeper purpose of sending Sam to the Wall is likely to kill him off and be rid of him forever, which I think we both kind of settled on.
Yeah.
But three, the Night's Watch seems like a more permanent position than becoming a maester, as we'll soon learn from a story Maester Aemon tells when he had the option to put aside his maester's oath to ascend to the kingship. That indicates to me that there's a little more wiggle room in a maester's oath than there seems to be at the Night's Watch. And I think that's the key. Like, there was one point in the realm where Maester Aemon could have, before he became a sworn brother of Night's Watch, they offered to let him cast off his maester's chain and become the king. That, and then I think after he declined, he took the black just so he would never be put in that position again.
Hmm.
So yeah, the maester thing seems like, I don't know if it's like...
Really? So he took the black? He wasn't just... assigned to the wall as the maester?
Nope.
Oh, the Citadel like turns at the wall into maesters, right?
I wonder if that's how. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but it makes sense because who the hell, like, you know? I think most maesters are kind of like they're not exactly Catholic priests, but they kind of take all the similar vows to the serve the realm instead of themselves. So there's a lot of the overlap, but there again, you can set that aside, whereas the Night's Watch, like, you can't. It's under penalty of death. So I think that's a pretty good explanation. I'd forgotten about that.
Maester Aemon, good or bad king?
He seems like a good king. He
seems pretty wise.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I
couldn't see shit, but...
Right, but by that time, he's like 100 years old at this point.
I know.
He's so old that people forgot that he was a Targaryen. Like, that's kind of like an open secret, because he's like, oh, he's been at the wall for so fucking long that generations of people have lived and died in this medieval hellhole, and they've forgotten about him. Michael K. said, do you believe that Jaime's distaste for Ned stems from the belief that the Ned Stark defeated Sir Arthur Dayne at the Tower of Joy, which gave Ned the reputation of being one of the best fighters in Westeros? An idea that we now know is skewed by the fact that Sir Arthur Dayne was stabbed in the back by Howland Reed. Is it possible that Jaime, who squired under Sir Barristan Selmy, who was close to Sir Arthur Dayne, has a general uncertainty that Ned Stark's the fighter everyone believes him to be? That's a good question that I don't know how I can answer. I think the key thing is, does Jaime suspect that Ned, because if Ned beat Sir Arthur Dayne, that's pretty fucking impressive because, everyone that in the universe seems to agree that in living memory, he was the absolute best swordsman alive. Now, I also think that there's a little bit like a Terrell Owens theory, or if you don't know who that is, just like in sports, you know, there's this tendency to say that you're the greatest. And like, you know, if you're talking about a guy who's maybe a little bit better than you, maybe not, it's a subjective thing to be like, oh, who's he? He's not shit. I feel like that's probably the same thing with swordsmen.
Sure.
Like if you get to the top five, they all think they're the best.
Right.
Maybe even the top 20. So what Jaime thinks and what he knows and what he suspects and what is just, you know, braggadocio, it's hard to separate.
Sure.
Anyway.
I don't really have an opinion on it.
All right. Nick G says, wondering why so many people think the wall will come down when Bran passes through it. I understand that Bran has a natural affinity to the magic of the North, but it seems like the Night King would have marked some ranger over the last 1,000 years since the last Long Night, bringing it down when they went back through.
Maybe he can't. Maybe he can only mark you in the vision type thing that happened with Bran.
Right. That's,
we just don't know the rules.
That's the thing. The magic is poorly understood, but the first thing that came to my mind is you could only do that to a green seer. And also a green seer that is
untrained.
And a green
seer can only break the magic spell on the wall. Like, who knows?
Yeah, because it wasn't a physical touch. It was a psychic touch that did it.
Right.
Was
it physical? Does he actually travel to places? We don't know. Like,
right.
Honestly, we have no freaking clue and no way to speculate on it.
Right. You're right. It's kind of a plot hole if he could just grab any old ranger, hands on him, and then the ranger is not going to suspect that, like, oh, I got a frostbite on my arm. It's going to turn the whole thing down.
Yeah.
I bet it's got to be, you got to be a green seer, you got to be jacked in the weirwood, and you got to be kind of unwary and untrained, and then they can get you.
Or maybe none of this shit will go down like we think it's going to. That will mean nothing in the long term.
That is also very plausible and true. Dasha from Russia says, I'm reading the first book again, and it seems that this whole Stark Wolves thing is much more symbolic than I first thought. In the book, their connection is shown with more details, and in the show, this plot line seems not that important. Even Ned realized that there was something special about them after Sansa's lady had been beheaded. He quotes, what was it that Jon had said when they found the pups in the snow? Your children were meant to have these pups, my lord. And he had killed Sansa's, and for what? Was it guilt that he was feeling, or fear? If the gods had sent these wolves, what folly had he done? And he was right. After her fate was completely ruined. Well, I mean, I could quibble with completely, because she's sitting pretty right now, but you're onto something here, Dasha. He goes down to run down the line. Arya beats her wolf Nymeria with sticks and stones and makes it leave. Is that a hint to Arya's future? Later, we'll struggle she'll struggle the same way to get rid of her own Stark self and her personality in order to become no one. In season 6, she comes back to being Arya Stark again, so I'm almost positive that we'll see her reunion with Nymeria in season 7 as a symbol of it. Jon's wolf is an albino, all white. First, I thought it was a parallel to Jon as an outsider bastard with the name Snow, but what if it's also a hint to him being a Targaryen, who were famous for their silver-white hair? I do think that there's a lot more to this wolf stuff than we realize, which why I was so shocked when Summer got killed last year, and Shaggy Dog, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff that Nymeria is doing in the Riverlands that we know from the book but we don't see in the show, I kind of want to see a scene of a dire wolf leading a whole pack of wolves to dispense some kind of justice.
It'd be an interesting, like, Jurassic Park style scene, right?
Yeah.
Where you're showing the intelligence of these animals and what they're doing.
Would Arya be Chris Pratt in that situation?
Yeah. She's the alpha.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, I mean, this is silly, but like literally Arya riding on the back of the Nymeria charging a pack of wolves. Like, maybe not that dumb, but if she has some kind of Beastmaster type thing where she can summon these wolves, and that would make her even more of a badass than she already is. Yeah, or maybe. They could just ignore it. There's only 13 episodes left.
She could take a wolf face. What if she could turn her face into a wolf?
Didn't work out so well for Rob.
No, it didn't.
Did not work out at all.
Nope.
Let's see. Shayna writes in, listening to last week's episode 1, or season 1, episode 4, Crippled Bastards and Broken Things cast, the complaint that the White Walkers are sitting around doing nothing came up yet again. I have a different perspective on why 7 seasons beyond this point, they are still dormant. The White Walkers seem to be immortal in the way they don't die naturally or re-die or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they're working on an altogether different timeline than mortal humans. They seem to appear in the deepest, coldest, worst of winter and move with the storm. This has only been the most recent season, season 6, that winter officially hit Westeros, according to the Maesters. The White Walkers might be waiting to move south with the worst of winter, attacking at a point where humans might not have as much food to eat, fuel resources to use, energy to expend would be a very advantageous move on their part. If memory serves, it has been predicted that this will be the worst winter in memory, or maybe since the Long Night even. Also, the White Walkers haven't attacked since that Long Night. If these undead, immortal, sentient, living weapons have waited 8,000 years to move south, what's a decade or two more to them? On a mortal timeline, sure. It feels like they've been doing nothing but sitting up north, twiddling their bony thumbs. But if you've been waiting over a millennia, why rush into battle and waiting a little bit more would give you a much greater upper hand? That's a good... Especially since
they're
not unbeatable. They were beaten. So maybe they're like, well, fuck this. We're going to get all of our ducks in a row before we move. Or, again, we don't really fully understand their motivations and their thoughts and feelings on the matter. So you're right. If you're 8,000 years old, 5 years is nothing. Hell, I'm 40.
Yeah.
And, like, the last decade has literally blurred by. It's
the
older you get, the faster it goes. It's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's any teenagers listening, enjoy the long, lazy, slow summers, man. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, I'm good.
Good thoughts. Tom H. from Kentucky. I was reading through A Storm of Swords and found the story of the Rat Cook really interesting. The Rat Cook baked an Andal's King's son into a pie and served it to them and was consequently cursed by the gods for violating guest right. I thought there was some certain parallels to Arya's killing of the Freys in episode 6:10. I'm sure Arya was familiar with the story of the Rat Cook as Bran heard it from Old Nan. Is it possible that she was directly inspired by the story? I was wondering if you guys were familiar with this relationship and discussed it anywhere.
I'm certainly not.
So they mentioned this in I believe the series when Bran was going through the Knight's Castle. With Hodor and Mira and Jojen, they were talking about the Rat King as kind of just a creepy story that Old Nan used to tell them. And this kind of happens in the books, too. I feel like that in the books, this scene with Arya was a remix of, like, kind of the part, the climax or maybe the opening salvo of the Grand Northern Conspiracy. Because in the books, Lord Manderly comes to Winterfell to celebrate the wedding of... Ramsay Bolton to fake Arya, And he brings a big mincemeat pies that you find out later are baked with a phrase that he personally has murdered. Hmm. And he's getting drunk, and he's requesting that the bard sing tales about the Rat King. And he's kind of like openly mocking the Freys and the Boltons to their face and disrespecting them. And we kind of leave everything right there in the middle. I know, like, you know, he eventually gets his throat cut, but he's all right. And then Stannis is attacking, and there's the siege, and then you get the pink letter and a bunch of confusing stuff, and then the book ends. So I feel like the Double D's thought that was really powerful imagery to serve a Frey their own sons in a pie, and they made it. Why not Arya?
Okay.
Why not do it with Arya?
Yeah, I thought the scene was effective, regardless of not knowing about that.
Right. Let's see this. I think this will be the final email we read for the spoiler section. Evan W. said, the last couple podcasts have touched on the book or show's depiction of certain aspects of being in the military that I find incredibly realistic. I'm not talking about fighting or the battles. I'll leave that to the historians. I'm talking about some of the day-to-day stuff that I find on point. The book and show opens with the ranging party that gets massacred because they're being led by a foolhardy officer. I don't know how many times I've heard someone complaining about someone up the chain of command having a visit from the fucking good idea fairy, or the number of memes I've seen passed around about a lieutenant being lost. I also found myself sympathizing with John during his adjustment to life at the Wall when he's finding out being a brother of the Night's Watch isn't all about slaying grumpkins and snarks.
Mm, yeah.
I joined the Air Force to have some adventures and see the world. I ended up 3 hours from where I grew up and spent more time in pointless meetings and briefings than I care to admit to the general public.
Yeah.
Much like John, I was dying to get to where the action was. It wasn't until I deployed to Afghanistan that I thought I was doing what I signed up for. I'm sure John felt the same way north of the Wall. Finally, to address a point made by a fellow podcast listener who thought it was unrealistic for Robert to not have killed someone until the rebellion, I would say I found it completely feasible. Some people are just killers. Some people can kill and do other incredible, terrible things on the battlefield and feel little to no remorse. Every time I hear the Hound say, Stannis is a killer, the Lannisters are killers, your father was a killer, your brother's a killer, your sons will be killers someday, this world is built by killers. It reminds me of what Richard Winters, who is the officer who led Easy Company of the 101st Airborne during Normandy's invasion in World War II and is featured in the book and miniseries Band of Brothers, that said some of the men that, said about some of the men he led. He literally used the phrase killers to describe them. He didn't mean it to be positive or negative. It was simply the truth. These are the kind of men you want in your infantry and certainly the kind of men you'd want leading your military. Based on everything we know about him, I think it's entirely possible Robert is one of these men. Overall, I imagine most veterans find some of the themes of the Gurm writes about regarding military service realistic. I know he's never served himself, but I imagine Gurm is a well-read individual and has picked up on these themes from reading books from the ones who have. That's interesting because George, I think, got deferments to not fight in Vietnam. And the person whose work he probably owes the most to, J.R.R. Tolkien, famously fought in the trenches of World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the criticism on Tolkien is that his world's not as grimy and realistic as George's.
Right.
Interesting. No, I you know, thanks for your service and thanks for your thoughts. Mm-hmm. I think they're interesting. Yeah, especially like obviously I don't think you go into the most armed services in a first world country and are serving shoulder to shoulder with rapists and thieves and murderers.
Right.
Or at least I hope not. But yeah, like that'd be pretty rough to, want adventure and then get stationed 3 hours from your home.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, do you have any thoughts on that?
No. Good to hear about it, though.
All right, that's all we got. Again, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. If you would like to send in emails, additional emails, and be considered for the podcast. Also, forums.baldmove.com. If you just want to discuss your thoughts and theories with your fellow fans, we'll be back next week for a Golden Crown, I believe, or the Golden Crown episode.
I think it's a Golden Crown, yeah.
One episode 106.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see you then.
See ya.